Hello and welcome to the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick and I'm here with Pastors Bob Thune and Dusty White of Coram Deo Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church in Bellevue, Nebraska. Every Wednesday we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today we're discussing the article from The Atlantic called Have Smartphones Destroyed a Generation?
One of the things we want to do on this podcast is help Christians be wise observers and students of culture. And so a lot of the topics we tackle just have to do with things that are going on in the world around us. We're called to be on mission for Jesus in a world that's quickly and rapidly changing. And so we try to analyze cultural trends as intelligently as we can for the sake of helping us live effectively on mission. Last week, we discussed Andy Crouch's book, The Tech Wise Family, which is a book about technology. And right on the heels of that podcast, this article in The Atlantic came out. It's in the September 2017 issue, and it's titled Have Smartphones Destroyed a Generation? So basically, right after we talked about all the Andy Crouch stuff and the data from Barna Research on teens and technology, this article came out, and it was a fascinating article because it's not written from a Christian perspective. The author is Jean Twenge, who's a psychology professor at San Diego State, and she has been researching generational trends for 25 years. And she starts this article saying this: around 2012, I noticed abrupt shifts in teen behaviors and emotional states. In all my analyses of generational data, some reaching back to the 1930s, I had never seen anything like it. At first, I presumed these might be blips, but the trends persisted across several years and a series of national surveys. And she goes on to ask the question, what happened in 2012 to cause such dramatic shifts in behavior? And her answer is this: it was exactly the moment when the proportion of Americans who owned a smartphone surpassed 50%. So here's what's interesting to me about the research that she's observing is we said last week on the podcast that the reason the TechWise Family book is intriguing to me is because we don't really know what technology is doing to the brains and the habits of young children. This is the first article I've seen that tries to trace that out, that tries to say, hey, here's some very, very new raw data on how smartphones are affecting especially children and teenagers. So Jean Twenge has labeled this generation iGen, and she says this relates to those born between 1995 and 2012. So it's sort of like right after the millennials, you have this up-and-coming generation, and she wants to call them iGen. I'm sure that's like a trademarked phrase because her book is titled something like iGen. So I'm sure this is sort of like her spin on, I'm trying to name the generation and be that person who everybody else looks back on and sort of admires. But it's fascinating that she says this generation, what defines this generation is most of them are growing up with smartphones. Because the iPhone was introduced in 2007, already quoted the stat that 50% of Americans owned a smartphone by 2012. And she's suggesting that the defining mark and feature of this generation of teenagers is their addiction to, their familiarity with, the way the smartphone defines their social interaction and existence. And Jean Twenge she writes this with some concern. Obviously, as a researcher and a scholar, she's sort of trying to be a good, unbiased academic, but she says, hey, I'm very, very concerned about what is happening, what the data seems to show. She says this: the advent of the smartphone was followed quickly by hand-wringing about the effects of screen time, but the impact of these devices has not been fully appreciated and goes far beyond the usual concerns about curtailed attention spans. The arrival of the smartphone has radically changed every aspect of teenagers' lives, from the nature of their social interactions to their mental health. Here is some of the data that she traces out in this article. She mentions the Monitoring the Future survey, which is a survey funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse. It's been going on since 1975. And she says the results could not be clearer. Teens who spend more time than average on screen activities are more likely to be unhappy. and those who spend more time than average on non-screen activities are more likely to be happy. There's not a single exception. All screen activities are linked to less happiness, and all non-screen activities are linked to more happiness. She goes on to quote these stats. Eighth graders who are heavy users of social media increase their risk of depression by 27%. Teens who spend 3 hours a day or more on electronic devices are 35% more likely to have a risk factor for suicide. Boys' depressive symptoms increased by 21% from 2012 to 2015, while girls increased by 50% in 3 years. Although the rates increased for both sexes, three times as many 12 to 14-year-old girls killed themselves in 2015 as in 2007, and twice as many boys. This is fascinating. Since 2007, the homicide rate among teens has declined, but the suicide rate has increased. As teens have started spending less time together, they've become less likely to kill one another and more likely to kill themselves. In 2011, for the first time in 24 years, the teen suicide rate was higher than the teen homicide rate. 57% more teens were sleep deprived in 2015 than in 1991. Now, as a researcher, she notes it's difficult to trace the precise paths of causation. It could be that smartphones are causing depression, or that people are feeling more depressed because, and that causes them to go to their smartphones. But she's just saying, as you analyze all the data, it seems that there's a strong correlation between the rise in smartphone use among teens and serious mental health concerns, serious suicide concerns, serious depression concerns. What she traces out in the article is, hey, today's teens are safer. They're not going out as much. They're not partying as much. They're not drinking as much. They're not having risky sex as much. All the things that sort of used to characterize teenage rebellion, they're actually, those stats are much better for this current generation, the iGen, as she calls them. So that's a brief summary of the article. Again, you can find it online at The Atlantic if you want to read the whole thing, but I just wanted to sort of summarize the data. And then, guys, I wanted to invite the conversation about what does this suggest as we look at this research? Number one, what are the opportunities here for the church? And number two, what are the important takeaways for parents, for youth ministry volunteers, for those working with, concerned about, and invested in the lives of youth and teenagers?
I think the thing that jumped out at me the most in this article is the social impact of how teens are relating to one another. And it seems that so much of it is now mediated through social media and more digital connection than actual face-to-face personal connection. So even talking about, and Bobby brought it up, the sexual activity of teenagers and how, if you start to dig into what's happening here, yes, teens are having sex less, which we can celebrate, but has that become all of a sudden because teens are, hey, sex before marriage is wrong and we're all more moral? No, it's they've replaced it with something else, something more digital. And so when you get inside that, it's a fascinating phenomenon because now it's disembodied sex. So not to say, oh yeah, teens go out and have sex, get away from the, you know, your smartphone and go actually do this with a normal person or a human being. Not saying that, but just the implications of that, of how socially teenagers in this generation are being disconnected and the implications of that. And one of the things that made me laugh about this article is when we're talking about driver's license and how teens now are less likely to get a driver's license because their parents just drive them everywhere. I'm thinking, man, when I turned 16, the day I turned 16, my mom pulled me out of school over lunch and I had my license. I'm like, she was like, I'm not driving you to practice anymore. But just those, there's just a number of those social aspects of this that are fascinating to me and just make me wonder. So when these teenagers become adults, how are they going to relate to people? What's this next generation going to look like socially? And the thing that also came to mind too is the book Brave New World. If you've read Brave New World, this utopia where basically everybody is controlled by their lusts, their passions, their desires, their pleasure. And so you have a society that isn't violent, that isn't rebellious, and it's not because everybody's become more moral or there's this tight-fisted dictatorship. It's because everybody has become lulled into a passivity. And so that's some of what I've seen here too is, I mean, the title of her book of how kids are safer and They're less rebellious. It's because they've been lulled into a passivity that we definitely can't call healthy. So those are some of the things that jumped out at me as I was reading this article.
It's interesting to me reading this article in tandem with Andy Crouch's book, because I just think it puts on the front burner the importance of being tech-wise, the importance of some of the boundaries and some of the, you know, Crouch uses the language of keeping technology in its proper place. And it certainly seems like that is so much more pressing of a concern viewing this research. I mean, I trusted, I took Andy Crouch's word for it in the first place, but viewing this research makes me see all the more, gosh, this is going to be the defining issue of this next generation.
So pastorally, reading this article, the thing that immediately jumped out to me is this issue of community. So we talk so much about the importance of community in your discipleship as a follower of Jesus and being part of a church, just even being a human being connected to community. And so if we have a generation that is becoming increasingly disconnected from vital human interaction, from intimate, vulnerable human action, and that's being mediated more and more through digital technology and social media. What does that say for how we disciple people and the implications pastorally of how do we foster genuine community when this upcoming generation is being more and more disconnected from that? And so that's really what struck me pastorally out of this, is like, wow, how is the church and how we talk about community and being connected, how are we gonna have to disciple people that are currently in high school and gonna be coming into our churches in the future?
Well, you're gonna have to teach some basic social skills.
Yeah.
A lot of discipleship is gonna revolve around how do you do human interaction. Like, that's gonna be more of a pressing concern than it ever has been. Jean Twenge has this line in this article. She says, in the next decade, we may see more adults who know just the right emoji for a situation, but not the right facial expression, which is troubling, right? But this is, wow. So a lot of discipleship is going to have to start helping people just understand some of the basic social interactions that in past years you could take for granted because people were socialized in that through human interaction, but mediated digital interaction does not train us in those same ways.
One of the things that strikes me is reading Steve Jobs' biography, and then my perspective on that guy is interesting. I have a love-hate relationship with who he is and what he's done, but he's quoted in this article as one who limited his kids' time on devices, and that's true of other people who live in Silicon Valley. I think it was James K. Smith, when he was here, talked about when he goes to Silicon Valley, which I lived there for 3 years, how there's flip phones everywhere. Because the tech people know exactly what the device is built to do. And so there's even resistance from some of, you could say, the smartest people in our nation, engineering-wise, to not be tethered all the time to the device. I think where this surprises me is that, I don't know about you guys, but I feel a little bit like, at least today, that technology has taking a body blow to the church, and we're going to have to take a stance on it, like we have sex, like we have abortion, like we have all these other things in our society. Now we have to take a stance. We have to kind of drive a stake in the ground on technology in general, which is interesting because the church is a community. So we have to interact about it.
Yeah, I disagree with you on the sort of needing to take a stand on it, although I think it's going to need to be something we wisely disciple people. And I think what's weird is technology itself is not inherently evil. Mm-hmm. And so I think we have to be careful that we don't overreact. But I do think, you know, Crouch makes the point in his book that we're probably more in danger of letting technology just sort of seep its way into our very existence than of having such strong boundaries that we become legalists. And so he's like, let's argue for boundaries are good rather than worrying about, oh gosh, if we start drawing lines in the sand, aren't we becoming legalists? And so I think that's what I hear you saying, Dusty, is that there's a need for us to be much more intentional about the ways that we sort of draw boundaries around and protect ourselves from the always encroaching reality of technology.
Yeah, I think what I'm trying to say there is we're going to have to help people understand technology if it is what Chris said, lulling us to sleep, because we're going to become just people who interact with our device all the time. kids are already doing this, according to this article. And then I see kids doing this in my neighborhood. They're like standing there, but staring down, you know? And so that's just interesting to think about, like, what are we going to, are we going to be okay with that as the church? Are we going to be okay with people just being on their devices, either in church on a Sunday morning or at youth group, perhaps? Are we going to be okay with just technology being out and about all the time, or how are we going to help kids?
Yeah. So I wonder if the language here that we need, or the way to couch some of this, so we don't sound like we're trying to be legalistic or draw boundaries or moralize something that doesn't need to be. But I wonder if we couch this language in how this technology is really dehumanizing and destroying our ability to have genuine community and relationships with people, and just pointing out, like, look, there's consequences to this. You can use technology in very helpful ways, or it can dehumanize you. And so we don't want to sound like we're Luddites here, but at the same time, let's just acknowledge what this is doing. And as for the church, what does this look like for us to be a refuge of this too? I mean, if this is true, if the stats here about the effect this is having on our generation are true, then these kids are crying for something authentic and real. And how can we as a church use technology wisely and offer a space and a community that is a respite from that and say, hey, we actually want to rehumanize you here and for you to experience something genuine and authentic. And so I wonder if that language, so I'm kind of thinking out loud here, I wonder if that language is helpful in how we both draw some boundaries, push people and disciple them in some ways, but without coming across as like, I'm anti-smartphone and, you know, everybody needs a flip phone and technology is evil.
I don't know. Part of me just wants to be a legalist. Like, as I read Crouch's, it's a little bit easier, but I just feel like, I think the scary thing about all of it, I think you said this last week, Bob, the scary thing is we're unaware yet of the effects.
Right.
Right.
Well, and this brings to mind Crouch's thing of no smartphones before double digits.
Right.
Like, you know, phasing in our kids' use of technology so that it's not the first thing they learn and the first thing they're familiar with, which, as I read the article, it seems to me like that's where the parents in the article are missing, or where maybe we could say where American parents in general are missing, is they've allowed technology to become a defining reality in kids' lives in ways that's very malformative.
Yeah, and so we have to start thinking actively about that instead of passively, which is just, that's challenging to me as a dad. Like, I have to actually start thinking about that, not as a legalist, even though that'd be easier. But I feel like Crouch's thing, a time limit in your home for screen time, things like that are going to be hard, fast stakes in the ground, if you will, for certain families that you're going to have to figure out how to be different with.
A line from the article here says, if you were going to give advice for a happy adolescence based on this survey, it would be straightforward. Put down the phone, turn off the laptop, and do something, anything, that does not involve a screen. Sounds like good advice. Sounds like another law to follow. How do we nuance that to give boundaries? When I think of the church, it's more broad than just parents setting up a rule for the house. How do we respond with the gospel that's not just, hey, don't do that, but be okay with, we might just need to say, don't do that anymore. Put that down.
I don't have a problem with the law.
That's where I'm leaning. Like, that's what I feel today. I remember, you know, when we were talking about the TechWise family last week, I kind of felt like, you know, you got to eat the meat, spit out the bones, stuff like that. The more I think about it, I'm like, no, I think until your kid is 15, 16, 20 and can understand independence, until they can get behind the wheel of a car, Chris, let's say 16, then we probably need to just help them with that.
This is where Christians, I think, have a really poorly nuanced understanding of sort of what legalism is, because legalism is, you know, God loves me because I follow this rule. God approves of me. God is pleased with me. I'm a better Christian. I'm a better person because I follow this rule. The existence of a rule does not mean you're a legalist, right? Like, saying you should not do this or you may not do this in this house is not legalism. It's just wisdom. That's why Proverbs is full of, you know, rules like, you know, the borrower becomes the lender's slave, or, you know, the principles that in a sense give us a clear path to follow and say, if you walk in this way, here's the result.
And let's also be clear too, we're talking about a very thin slice of technology here. We're not like banning all technology and all technologies. This is just
particularly the smartphone.
Being careful about one particular type of technology that we engage with, and just being thoughtful about that. So this is not a broad brush. This is not overreaching. And like to your point, Bob, for a mom and dad, for parents to say, hey, you want a phone? Cool, you're getting a flip phone. Yep. No smartphones. I mean, so what?
But it takes me longer to text, Chris, because I have to press
the button. Then I would have to call
T9
you.
T9. Oh, man.
That means you want me to call you if you give me a flip phone? Interesting.
Amazing, because we have to actually connect through our voices.
Okay, so getting back to the question of what does this mean for the church and its ministry and for sort of gospel formation, and Crouch makes this point in his book too, the church needs to be the first family. And so if we think about what is reshaping and reforming of this, what Gene Twenge calls the iGen, you know, this generation of students as they grow into adulthood, the church is going to have to become a place where those people are welcome and invited into a different rhythm, a different way of being, Chris, a different way of being human, as you're saying. And that's going to require us showing the beauty of a different way of being human, right? Showing the, what's fascinating is I think even this article points out some teenagers are already self-aware of the problems. Like she traces this 13-year-old girl, Athena, through the article and sort of this narrative stream. And at the end of the article, it talks about this girl's frustrated because she's sitting around with her friends and trying to tell them something meaningful. And they're all down on their phones like, she's like mad at her friends. Like, you're not listening to what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is this implicit understanding that more and more will be realized of, gosh, something's missing in the humanness of our interaction here. Mm-hmm. And if the church can be a place where true humanity is honored and valued, where true community is cultivated and built, where things are not mediated through technology, but rather there's a sort of presence that we cultivate that's real and flesh and blood, that can be a serious counterformative practice to sort of the disformative or malformative effects of technology. Mm.
I think if you're going to have a rule like in your house, don't, you know, put down the phone, no phones at dinner time, things like that. No phones at bedtime. Having a more rounded out theology and explanation of who we have our being, like who we find our meaning in. Because if kids are finding their meaning in those digital relationships, I think to help our kids, to help this generation understand why that's important, you're going to have to help them see why community is important. I don't think the answer is just, well, just hang out with your friends and do things with your friends. The answer has to be, you know, you have your being in something so much more than beyond your phone, beyond the relationships you have.
And Christian parents and Christian churches are going to have to give students a vision of being countercultural in this area.
Yeah.
Because if you're in a group of friends where everybody has a smartphone and everybody's on their smartphone all the time, I teased my son because we had a bunch of his friends over to the house for dinner a few weeks ago. And after dinner, those guys were all sitting around like playing this online poker game. Like, I had seven teenage boys in my house and my son was the only one not on his phone. And those guys were like all on their phones. And I was just teasing the guys like, hey, so this is what you guys do when you hang out, is like everybody sits around on their phone and just, you know, plays online poker or posts stuff on Snapchat. And so I think there's a, there's an invitation to a different way of being there, that can be compelling.
So did you break out your cards and your poker chips and
you
like
take all their money.
Invite them into a real poker game?
That's what we're all waiting for.
I mean, if I was good at poker, I might've done that, but I'd probably lose a lot of money in that scenario. Plus, I don't want to teach them to gamble.
They go to the pastor's house and come back. Yeah. Hey, I learned how to gamble.
I lost a bunch of money to that pastor.
So, Mike, to piggyback off your point, too, with that must come a bigger vision. I like what you were saying, that, hey, it's not just don't look at your smartphone. That stuff rots your brain. Don't watch too much TV. But it's, hey, parents, not just tell your kids don't, or, you know, make this rule, but in that time where they might be looking at their smartphone, what does it look like for them to actually engage you? You spend time with them. So then what is that also countering this idea that my identity and my sense of like love is not in how many likes I get on Instagram or, but in actually experiencing love from my parents and from that being discipled into ultimately my identities in Christ. But that the value comes from tangible human relationships, my relationship with Christ, and not this mediated digital, someone pushed the heart button on my post. But that comes not just from lectures, but from kids actually experiencing genuine community. And so I think for parents, it's not just create this rule, but actually engage and disciple them in something greater and let them experience that greater thing.
That'll do it for this week's conversation. The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in, and we pray that the things that we've talked about might also be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. Make sure you check out the episode notes to find the direct link to this article. Read it. Shoot us an email, podcast@cdomaha.com, and engage this conversation with us. Join us next Wednesday for another Wednesday conversation.